Hunting people isn't really right, though, said McGrath.
Well, no, Granny Weatherwax conceded. But it was only if they'd done something bad. He said they enjoyed it, really. He used to let them go, if they gave him a good run.
And then there was that great hairy thing of his, said Nanny Ogg.
There was a perceptible change in the atmosphere. It became warmer, darker, filled at the corners with the shadow of unspoken conspiracy.
Ah, said Granny Weatherwax distantly, his droit de seigneur.
Needed a lot of exercise, said Nanny Ogg, staring at the fire.
But next day he'd send his housekeeper round with a bag of silver and a hamper of stuff for the wedding, said Granny. Many a couple got a proper start in life, thanks to that.
Ah, agreed Nanny. One or two individuals, too.
Every inch a king, said Granny.
What are you talking about?
Said McGrath suspiciously.
Did he keep pets?
The two witches surfaced from whatever deep current they had been swimming in. Granny Weatherwax shrugged.
I must say, McGrath went on in severe tones, if you think so much of the old king, you don't seem very worried about him being killed. I mean, it was a pretty suspicious accident.
That's kings for you, said Granny. They come and go, good and bad. His father poisoned the king we had before.
That was old Thargum, said Nanny Ogg.
Had a big red beard, I recall. He was very gracious, too, you know.
Only now no one must say Felmet killed the king, said McGrath.
What?
Said Granny. He had some people executed in Loncre the other day for saying it, McGrath went on. Spreading malicious lies, he said. He said anyone saying different will see the insides of his dungeons. Only not for long. He said Berents died of natural causes.
Well, being assassinated is natural causes for a king, said Granny. I don't see why he's so sheepish about it. When old Thargum was killed, they stuck his head on a pole, had a big bonfire, and everyone in the palace got drunk for a week.
I remember, said Nanny. They carried his head all round the villages to show he was dead. Very convincing, I thought. Especially for him. He was grinning. I think it was the way he would have liked to go.
I think we might have to keep an eye on this one, though, said Granny. I think he might be a bit clever. That's not a good thing in a king. And I don't think he knows how to show respect.
A man came to see me last week to ask if I wanted to pay any taxes, said McGrath. I told him no.
He came to see me, too, said Nanny Ogg. But our Jason and our Wayne went out and told him we didn't want to join. Small man, bald, black cloak, said Granny thoughtfully.
Yes, said the other two.
He was hanging about in my raspberry bushes, said Granny. Only when I went out to see what he wanted, he ran away.
Actually, I gave him tuppence, said McGrath. He said he was going to be tortured, you see, if he didn't get witches to pay their taxes.
Lord Felmet looked carefully at the two coins in his lap. Then he looked at his tax-gatherer.
Well,
he said. The tax-gatherer cleared his throat.
Well, sir, you see, I explained about the need to employ a standing army, etc., and they said why. And I said, because of bandits, etc., and they said bandits never bothered them.
And civil works?
Ah, yes. Well, I pointed out the need to build and maintain bridges, etc.
And?
They said they didn't use them.
Ah, said the Duke knowledgeably. They can't cross running water.
Not sure about that, sir. I think witches cross anything they like.
Did they say anything else?
Said the Duke. The tax gatherer twisted the hem of his robe distractedly. Well, sir, I mentioned how taxes helped to maintain the king's peace, sir.
And?
They said the king should maintain his own peace, sir, and then they gave me a look.
What sort of look?
The Duke sat with his thin face cupped in one hand. He was fascinated.
It's sort of hard to describe, said the taxman.
He tried to avoid Lord Felmet's gaze, which was giving him the distinct impression that the tiled floor was fleeing away in all directions and had already covered several acres. Lord Felmet's fascination was to him what a pin is to a purple emperor.
Try,
Duke invited. The taxman blushed.
Well, he said, it wasn't nice.
Which demonstrates that the tax gatherer was much better at figures than words. What he would have said if embarrassment, fear, poor memory, and a complete lack of any kind of imagination hadn't conspired against it was, when I was a little boy and staying with my aunt, and she had told me not to touch the cream, etc., and she had put it on a high shelf in the pantry, and I had got a stool and went after it when she was out anyway, and she'd come back and I didn't know, and I couldn't reach the ball properly, and it smashed to the floor, and she opened the door and glared at me. It was that look. But the worst thing was, they knew it.
Not nice, said the Duke.
No, sir. The Duke drummed the fingers of his left hand on the arm of his throne. The tax gatherer coughed again.
You're not going to force me to go back, are you?
He said.
Hmm?
Said the Duke, waved a hand irritably.
No, no, he said. Not at all. Just call in at the torturer on your way out. See when he can fit you in.
The taxman gave him a look of gratitude and bobbed a bow.
Yes, sir. At once, sir. Thank you, sir. You're very...
Yes, yes,
said Lord Felmet absently.
You may go.
The Duke was left alone in the vastness of the hall. It was raining again. Every once in a while, a piece of plaster smashed down on the tiles, and there was a crunching from the walls as they settled still further. The air smelled of old cellars.
Gods,
he hated this kingdom. It was so small, only 40 miles long and maybe 10 miles wide, and nearly all of it was cruel mountains with ice-green slopes and knife-edge crests, or dense, huddled forests. A kingdom like that shouldn't be any trouble. What he couldn't quite fathom was this feeling that it had depth. It seemed to contain far too much geography. He rose and paced the floor to the balcony, with its unrivalled view of trees. It struck him that the trees were also looking back at him. He could feel the resentment, but that was odd, because the people themselves hadn't objected. They didn't seem to object to anything very much. Berents had been popular enough in his way. There'd been quite a turn-up for the funeral. He recalled the lines of solemn faces, not stupid faces, by no means stupid, just preoccupied, as though what kings did wasn't really very important. He found that almost as annoying as trees. A jolly good riot now. That would have been more appropriate. One could have ridden out and hanged people. There would have been the creative tension so essential to the proper development of the state. Back down on the plains, if you kicked people, they kicked back. Up here, when you kicked people, they moved away, and just waited patiently for your leg to fall off. How could a king go down in history ruling a people like that? You couldn't oppress them any more than you could oppress a mattress. He had raised taxes and burned a few villages on general principles, just to show everyone who they were dealing with. Didn't seem to have any effect. And then there were these witches. They haunted him.
Fool!
The fool, who had been having a quiet doze behind the throne, awoke in terror.
Yes?
Come hither, fool.
The fool jingled miserably across the floor.
Tell me, fool, does it always rain here?
Marry, Nuncle.
Just answer the question,
said Lord Filmot with iron patience.
Sometimes it stops, sir, to make room for the snow, and sometimes we get some right squandering, orgulous fogs, said the fool.
Orgulous?
Said the Duke absently. The fool couldn't stop himself.
His horrified ears heard his mouth blurt out, Thick, my lord, from the Latatian orgulum, of soup or broth.
But the Duke wasn't listening. Listening to the prattling of underlings was not, in his experience, particularly worthwhile.
I'm bored, fool.
Let me entertain you, my lord, with many a merry quip and lightsome jest.
Try me.
The fool licked his dry lips. He hadn't actually expected this. King Verence had been happy enough just to give him a kick or throw a bottle at his head. A real king.
I'm waiting. Make me laugh.
The fool took the plunge.
Why, sir? He quavered. Why may a cordled fill horse be deemed the brother to a Hiron candle in the night?
The Duke frowned. The fool felt it better not to wait.
Withal, because a candle may be greased, yet a fill horse be without a fat argier, he said,
and because it was part of the joke, patted Lord Filmot lightly with his balloon on a stick and twanged his mandolin. The Duke's index finger tapped an abrupt tattoo on the arm of his throne.
Yes,
he said.
And then what happened?
That, was by way of being the whole thing, said the fool,
and added,
My grandad thought it was one of his best.
I dare say he told it differently, said the Duke.
He stood up.
Summon my huntsman. I think I shall ride out on the chase, and you can come too.
My lord, I cannot ride.
For the first time that morning, Lord Filmot smiled.
Capital,
he said.
We will give you a horse that can't be ridden.
He looked down at his bandages, and afterwards he told himself, I'll get the armourer to send me up a file. A year went past. The days followed one another patiently. Right back at the beginning of the multiverse, they had tried all passing at the same time, and it hadn't worked. Tom John sat under Howell's rickety table, watching his father as he walked up and down between the lattice, waving one arm and talking. Fatala always waved his arms when he spoke. If you tied his hands behind his back, he would be dumb.
All right, he was saying. How about the king's brides?
Last year,
said the voice of Howell.
All right, then. We'll give them Mallow, the tyrant of Clatch, said Vitola.
And his larynx smoothly changed gear as his voice became a great rolling thing that could rattle the windows across the width of the average town square.
In blood I came, and by blood rule. No one will dare essay these walls of blood.
We did it the year before,
said Howell calmly.
Anyway, people are fed up with kings. They want a bit of a chuckle.
They are not fed up with my kings, said Vitola. My dear boy, people do not come to the theatre to laugh. They come to experience, to learn, to wonder.
To laugh, said Howell flatly. Have a look at this one.
Tom John heard the rustle of papers and the creak of wickerwork as Vitola lowered his weight onto the prop basket.
A wizard of sorts, Vitola read. Or please yourself.
Howell stretched his legs under the table and dislodged Tom John. He hauled the boy out by one ear.
What's this? Said Vitola. Wizards, demons, imps, merchants.
I'm rather pleased with Act Two, Scene Four,
said Howell, propelling the toddler towards the prop box.
Comic washing up with two servants?
Any deathbed scenes? Said Vitola, hopefully.
No,
said Howell.
But I can do you a humorous monologue in Act Three.
A humorous monologue?
All right. There's room for a soliloquy in the last act, said Howell hurriedly. I'll write one tonight, no problem.
And a stabbing,
said Vitola, getting to his feet.
A foul murder that always goes down well.
He strode away to organize the setting up of the stage. Howell sighed and picked up his quill. Somewhere behind the sacking walls was the town of Hangdog, which had somehow allowed itself to be built in a hollow, perched in the near sheer walls of the canyon. There was plenty of flat ground in the ramtops. The problem was that nearly all of it was vertical. Howell didn't like the ramtops, which was odd, because it was traditional dwarf country and he was a dwarf. But he'd been banished from his tribe years ago, not only because of his claustrophobia, but also because he had a tendency to daydream. It was felt by the local dwarf king that this is not a valuable talent for someone who is supposed to swing a pickaxe without forgetting what he is supposed to hit with it. And so Howell had been given a very small bag of gold, the tribe's heartfelt best wishes, and a firm goodbye. It had happened that Batola's strolling players had been passing through at the time, and the dwarf had ventured one small copper coin on a performance of The Dragon of the Plains. He had watched it without a muscle moving in his face, gone back to his lodgings, and in the morning had knocked on Vitola's lattie with the first draft of King Under the Mountain. It wasn't in fact very good, but Vitola had been perceptive enough to see that inside the hairy bullet head was an imagination big enough to bestride the world, and so, when the strolling players strolled off, one of them was running to keep up. Particles of raw inspiration sleep through the universe all the time. Every once in a while, one of them hits a receptive mind, which then invents DNA, or the flute sonata form, or a way of making light bulbs wear out in half the time. But most of them miss. Most people go through their lives without being hit by even one. Some people are even more unfortunate. They get them all. Such a one was Howell. Enough inspirations to equip a complete history of the performing arts poured continuously into a small, heavy skull designed by evolution to do nothing more spectacular than be remarkably resistant to axe blows. He licked his quill and looked bashfully around the camp. No one was watching. He carefully lifted up the wizard and revealed another stack of paper. It wasn't another potboiler. Every page was stained with sweat, and the words themselves scrawled across the manuscript on a trellis of blots and crossings out, and tiny scribbled insertions. Howell stared at it for a moment, alone in a world that consisted of him, the next blank page, and the shouting, clamorous voices that haunted his dreams. He began to write. Free of Howell's never too stringent attention, Tom John pushed open the lid of the props hamper, and in the methodical way of the very young, began to unpack the crowns. The dwarf stuck out his tongue as he piloted the errant quill across the ink-speckled page. He'd found room for the star-crossed lovers, the comic gravediggers, and the hunchback king. It was the cats and the roller skates that were currently giving him trouble. A gurgle made him look up.
"For goodness sake, lad," he said. "It hardly fits. Put it back."
The disc rolled into winter. Winter in the ramtops could not honestly be described as a magical frosty wonderland, each twig laced with the confections of brittle ice. Winter in the ramtops didn't mess about. It was a gateway straight through to the primeval coldness that lived before the creation of the world. Winter in the ramtops was several yards of snow, the forest a mere collection of shadowy green tunnels under the drifts. Winter meant the coming of the lazy wind, which couldn't be bothered to blow around people, and blew right through them instead. The idea that winter could actually be enjoyed would never have occurred to Ramtop people, who had 18 different words for snow, all of them unfortunately unprintable. The ghost of King Varence prowled the battlements, bereft and hungry, and stared out across his beloved forests and waited his chance. It was a winter of portents. Comets sparkled against the chilled skies at night. Clouds, shaped like mighty whales and dragons, drifted over the land by day. In the village of Razorback, a cat gave birth to a two-headed kitten. But since Gribo, by dint of considerable effort, was every male ancestor for the last 30 generations, this probably wasn't all that portentous. However, in Badass, a cockerel laid an egg and had to put up with some very embarrassing personal questions. In Loncratown, a man swore he'd met a man who had actually seen with his own eyes a tree get up and walk. There was a short, sharp shower of shrimps. There were odd lights in the sky. Geese walked backwards. Above all of this flared the great curtains of cold fire that were the Aurora Coriolis, the hub lights, whose frosty tints illuminated and coloured the midnight snows. There was nothing the least unusual about any of this. The ramtops, which, as it were, lay across the disk's vast, magical standing wave, like an iron bar dropped innocently across a pair of subway rails, were so saturated with magic that it was constantly discharging itself into the environment. People would wake up in the middle of the night, mutter, "Oh, it's just another bloody portent," and go back to sleep. Hog's Watch Night came round, marking the start of another year, and with alarming suddenness, nothing happened. The skies were clear, the snow deep and crisped like icing sugar. The freezing forests were silent and smelled of tin. The only things that fell from the sky were the occasional fresh showers of snow. A man walked across the moors from Razorback to Loncratown without seeing a single marsh light. Headless dog, strolling tree, ghostly coach or comet, and had to be taken in by a tavern and given a drink to unsteady his nerves. The stoicism of the ramtoppers developed over the years as a sovereign resistance to the thaumaturgical chaos, found itself unable to cope with the sudden change. It was like a noise which isn't heard until it stops. Granny Weatherwax heard it now, as she lay snug under a pile of quilts in her freezing bedroom. Hog's Watch Night is traditionally the one night of the disk's long year when witches are expected to stay at home, and she'd had an early night in the company of a bag of apples and a stone-hot water bottle, but something had awoken her from her doze. An ordinary person would have crept downstairs, possibly armed with a poker. Granny simply hugged her knees and let her mind wander. It hadn't been in the house. She could feel the small, fast minds of mice and the fuzzy minds of her goats as they lay in their cosy flatulence in the outhouse. A hunting owl was a sudden dagger of alertness as it glided over the rooftops. Granny concentrated harder until her mind was full of the tiny chittering of the insects in the thatch and the woodworm in the beams. Nothing of interest there. She snuggled down and let herself drift out into the forest, which was silent except for the occasional muffled thump as snow slid off a tree. Even in midwinter, the forest was full of life, usually dozing in burrows or hibernating in the middle of trees. All as usual. She spread herself further to the high moors and secret passes where the wolves ran silent over the frozen crust. She touched their minds, sharp as knives, higher still, and there was nothing in the snowfields but packs of vermin. The vermin is a small black-and-white furry creature, much framed for its pelt. It is a more careful relative of the lemming. It only throws itself off small pebbles. Everything was as it should be, with the exception that nothing was right. It was something. Yes. There was something alive out there, something young and ancient and... Granny turned over the feeling in her mind. Yes, that was it. Something forlorn, something lost. And feelings were never simple, Granny knew. Stripped them away, and there were others underneath. Something that, if it didn't stop feeling lost and forlorn very soon, was going to get angry. And still she couldn't find it. She could feel the tiny mines of chrysalises down under the frozen leaf mould. She could sense the earthworms, which had migrated below the frost line. She could even sense a few people, who were the hardest of all. Human minds were thinking so many thoughts all at the same time that they were nearly impossible to locate. It was like trying to nail a fog to the wall. Nothing there. Nothing there. The feeling was all around her, and there was nothing to cause it. She'd gone down about as far as she could, to the smallest creature in the kingdom, and there was nothing there. Granny Weatherwax sat up in bed, lit a candle, and reached for an apple. She glared at her bedroom wall. She didn't like being beaten. There was something out there. Something drinking in magic. Something growing. Something that seemed so alive it was all around the house, and she couldn't find it. She reduced the apple to its core and placed it carefully in the tray of the candlestick. Then she blew out the candle. The cold velvet of night slid back into the room. Granny had one last try. Perhaps she was looking in the wrong way. A moment later she was lying on the floor with the pillow clasped around her head. And to think she had expected it to be small.